Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical commentary, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email or via call. And before I give out those numbers, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. A couple of emails to start out today. This from Sharon in Watsonville. My 26-year-old son, who has no medical insurance and limited funds, has what he's terming a hernia near his belly button. It tends to pop out during exercises. Is this something that could be dangerous? Should he try to obtain Medi-Cal funding to have it addressed? Is there anything he could do to address it besides surgery? Well, obviously, we're not sure exactly what Sharon's son has, but assuming that he has a umbilical hernia, then what we would want him to do is watch carefully for things that are going to increase intra-abdominal pressure. And the abdominal wall can develop these openings, rather like runs in a nylon stocking. And the first thing that will protrude out is fat. So people who have a lot of fat will tend to do this more readily than those who are thin. If a loop of intestine accompanies that fat and the hernia is relatively small, so this happens most commonly with inguinal hernias in the groin, then that loop of intestine can actually become strangulated or entrapped. And that can lead to gangrene of the bowel. Very bad. Very uncommon with umbilical hernias. So these are hernias that are repaired electively. One of the things your son can do is reduce his weight, and the other is when he's lifting things, he should exhale and not hold his breath, because that will tend to increase the pressure and possibly widen the hernia. And avoiding getting constipated, for obvious reasons, that kind of bearing down is likely to open up the hernia more. This one from Anonymous in Santa Cruz. And just to preface this one, I think we are going to be asking a lot of questions now that we have this new technology. What I'm talking about will become apparent as I read the email. I recently tested as HPV positive with no changes in my cervix. I'm a 52-year-old woman and had not been sexually active for 8.5 years until this past February. My current partner had never heard of HPV before. I'd like more information about the dormancy period of this HPV and would also like to know if there are any herbs that might be helpful as far as strengthening my immune system. So, Anonymous, first of all, for the audience, HPV is human papillomavirus or venereal warts, and we have a test now that looks for the high-risk strains of HPV, and it is a test for the cervix, so typically gets run on pap smears. And there is actually no consensus about whether to run this on everybody or not. And you're looking at the reason that that consensus doesn't exist. Some doctors only get an HPV if the pap smear is abnormal, and you can order it that way. Other doctors routinely get both the pap smear and the HPV. And it's extremely important that we figure out what's the better tactic here, because right now we're not doing things uniformly and it's quite chaotic. But basically, if the person has the presence of one of these viruses that can mutate DNA and are associated with cervical cancer, the question is, how do we treat it? And we don't. We watch. And in the case of human papillomavirus, we've only really had this test deployed widely for about 5 years. So we don't know about latency and dormancy very well. We have some ideas that this virus is usually contracted through sex, and that during the initial infection, you can culture it, or rather detect this HPV from virus shed off of the cervix. Later on, the person appears to clear the virus, then we are no longer able to detect it in shed cells. We may still see changes in the cells that suggest that there's ongoing active viral replication at a low level, but we're not even really sure of that. After a period of time, it appears that most people clear the virus, but some people may have it dormant in the same way that chickenpox lies dormant in the spinal column and comes up 50 years later as shingles. And we don't have the long-term data to tell us what the frequency of that particular thing is. The other thing we know about such viruses is that they can reactivate. And again, we have very little data about reactivation. In the case of human papillomavirus, in the adult American population, we're looking at about 30% of people who show blood antibody, therefore are positive for having been infected with the virus. And that means that there's an awful lot of viral shedding that's completely asymptomatic going on. And if the person you're sleeping with has ever had sex with anybody else, there's about a 30% chance that they've been exposed to HPV. Well, it makes it hard to stigmatize something when it's that common. So we have to take a deep breath. And when someone gets told they have HPV positivity, not get overly excited about it. Look at the cervix. If the cervix is normal, then you monitor. And my current recommendation to this listener is that HPV means annual pap smears. Follow the HPV. And even after you've cleared it, I would probably continue to get annual pap smears for the rest of my life. The other thing I would want to say to Anonymous is if you smoke cigarettes, stop. There's a huge correlation between having HPV and having it advanced to cervical cancer and smoking. And the third thing is that folic acid, taking at a dose of about 800 micrograms per day, has been shown to improve the rate of clearance of the cervical changes that we associate with this virus. I'm not aware if the study looked at viral clearance, but I know it looked at cervical dysplasia and showed improved regression of those changes with the use of folic acid. Our next email from Anna in Milwaukee. Anna writes, autism and gut infection in her title. Recent studies have shown that there may be a link between a Clostridium infection in the intestines and autism. I believe that this theory needs an advocate because if it is found to be true, it would explain the clusters of autism outbreaks and allow for a potential cure, Difacid or antibiotics, for this disease. Please look at this and let your listeners know what you think about this theory. Well, the hypothesis that the gut microflora environment in autistic children is fundamentally different, inflamed, and therefore a different kind of ecology, an inflamed ecology, an autoimmune ecology, an ecology that has hyperpermeabilities, an ecology that's breaking down food substances differently and creating bacterial metabolic byproducts that might actually go to the bloodstream and cross the blood-brain barrier and act as intoxicants. That's the sort of elaborated hypothesis here of the gut. Even the studies that initially implicated the measles vaccine that got the whole autism is caused by measles vaccine, which it is not, that study was from a gastrointestinal clinic. It was looking at children who had very, very inflamed intestines. And there is probably something to this, but it's a very complicated chicken and the egg issue. Now, to the study that Anne referred us to, this was published in the Journal of Medical Microbiology, Volume 24, it was 2005. And the fecal flora of children with autism, their family members who were non-autistic, and other children who were unrelated and not in the same household and without autism spectrum disorder were looked at. And they found that there was a continuum, which is no surprise. The healthy, unaffected children had very low levels of Clostridium histolyticum. And these children who had the autism had higher levels, a higher incidence of infection by that bacteria. That bacteria is known to produce toxins. All of the Clostridia, in fact, produce toxins. That's tetanus, that's cholera. So obviously a genus of bacteria that are really into making environmental products that get released into the environment and then wreak havoc on other cells. Anyway, could this be a factor in autism? If you look anecdotally at the forums and the places where parents are talking about managing their autistic children, there are huge numbers of anecdotal stories about changing the diet and there being a correlation between real flare-ups of behavior and the appearance of the stools, diarrhea, abnormal stools. So yeah, there's probably a gut-brain connection, and yeah, the micro environment of the gut in autistic children is different, and yeah, if you shift that microenvironment, you tend to get changes in the severity of the autism. Are we putting the cart before the horse, the chicken before the egg? Is that even a meaningful question? Really, the question is, how do we treat autism? Can we improve it by making these changes systematically across a cohort? And there is data that diet does help. So plenty of information out there on the web on the ketogenic diet, plenty of passionate advocates and people who will help you do that for your autistic child. I think it's in the worth a try, won't hurt, might help category, which is where a lot of the evidence on complex chronic disease will remain due to the difficulty of isolating all the variables for a standard of a gold standard study. Loyal listener and web crawler Duff in Felton sent this one in. Neuroscientists map a new target to wipe pain away. Researchers at the Indiana University School of Medicine have discovered a peptide that short-circuits a pathway for chronic pain. This was published in the June 5th issue of Nature Medicine. Earlier research has shown that the pain signals in the spinal column, those nociceptive fibers that you've heard me talk about from time to time, have a lot of calcium channels, and it's a key player in uplinking and in the modification of how much pain signal is going to get sent to the brain. So we know that calcium channels are important. The problem is they're not just important in pain signals. Calcium channels are extremely important in muscle function, and that means heart function. So when we've tried to mess around with calcium channels for pain, we've run into a fair amount of toxicity because these drugs also affect the cardiac rhythm. Not a good thing to mess with. Based on this research, Rashish Khanna, being the principal investigator at Indiana University, they believe they've found an axonal protein that binds to the calcium channel and really acts like a remote control. This protein is fairly large, but this lab in Indiana has found that a subunit of this protein can be manufactured, essentially grown, and given systemically as a drug. In, at least in a mouse model, blocks the transmission of the pain signal. So it's a novel peptide, and it doesn't interfere with the types of calcium gates that are used for the heart. So this is an extremely important advance in our research of pain, and I anticipate will be taking us a long way forward as they manage to turn this thing into a drug. Now, time to delivery, probably 5 years at best. Cost when it comes out, probably pretty expensive. But if you are a chronic pain patient or you know a chronic pain patient, the augmentation of the pain signal such that everything hurts is a really horrible place to be. I will throw out that I have seen that respond very well to spinal stimulators. I've seen it respond very well to acupuncture. Obviously, the second is near and dearer to my heart because it doesn't involve sticking a needle into the spinal column. Let's switch gears a little bit. I have a question out there for you. I always encounter people who are involved in maybe a network marketing thing with a little bit of skepticism. So, for example, patient will come in and they have this great vitamin or this great juice or this great health thing that's made from some South American berry that's got, you know, a fabulous IROC potential, very high antioxidant. And it's like, yeah, and guess what? You can make a lot of money getting other people to sell it and you become a distributor and it's this pyramid thing. And I think we're all a little sour on pyramided things after the financial crises of the last 3 or 4 years. So, would it bother you to know that the surgeon who's suggesting that you have a particular new and improved device implanted in your body is involved in a distributorship and gets a piece of every device that he sells, I would get a little bit worried about whether I was getting completely disinterested advice and really getting the straight shot on this is better than the old thing. The new and improved marketing plan, well, gee. And the Senate's getting a little worried about that as well. The U.S. senators, five senators, I should say, have asked the Inspector General to open an investigation into these physician-owned distributorships. I didn't even know that this existed until reading about this. But in 20 states in the United States, surgeons can essentially purchase a dealership for medical devices, and they receive financial incentives, direct commissions for using these medical devices in their patients. That is a bad precedent. That is a conflict of interest, and we really need to think about whether we want to allow that. I do think that doctors, I'm sorry if this is an important part of your practice income, but I think we have a standard of disinterestedness that we need to maintain. I think it's all right to sell vitamins or nutritionals in your office. I do it myself, and I do it mainly because if I send a patient to the store with a list of things, they rarely get the right things. And so I offer it as a convenience, but I don't make the person use them. I don't offer the, I know just what you need and I just happen to have it here approach. I think that's really a slippery slope. And when it comes to something that's implanted in the body, there really needs to be a sense that the person doing the implanting is choosing the best device with the best track record for the individual without any reason to pick one device over the other. Commissions or kickbacks or whatever you call them set up a really difficult moral dilemma. I'm sorry, I really do believe this needs to be outlawed. There's a lot of rules around, for example, the operating facilities that we call outpatient surgical centers and who can own them and how much hands-off doctors have to have. And there's a good reason for that. And that's just where you get operated on, for goodness sake, not what's put into your body. So if we regulate how much of a piece of a surgery center a doctor can own, we really need to regulate how much of a piece of, how much of self-interest you can have on the medical device. I think I've covered this one well enough. Let's go to Demetra in Santa Cruz. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to get your advice about that, your suggestions about any herbs that women can take who are past menopause that can add or stimulate the body to get more estrogen. And for me, I have to be careful because both sisters had breast cancer. They live differently than I do. I'm pretty healthy. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had cancer, so I'm the middle child. So,
all right. Okay, well, let me start with the concept that when we're talking about hormones, to realize that hormones are not drugs. With a drug, generally what happens is a little bit does nothing, and then you get enough, and it does something, and then you take too much, and it does more of the same thing. Uh-huh. And then eventually you get into the toxic range. Actually, hormones work a little bit differently. And generally, a little bit and a whole lot don't work. And there's a sweet spot in the middle that does. And when we are making our estrogen during our reproductive years, the levels that we have as a reproductive female are in that sweet spot of getting maximum response. And if you actually get a tumor, let's say, that makes too much estrogen, you block your estrogen receptors and you get a reduction in estrogen effect, which is very paradoxical, but it's how hormones work. So the reason this is important is when we talk about herbal plant analogs or phytoestrogens, we're talking about things that are very weak. And so you have to get the dose right in order to have a proestrogen effect. And many times, if there's no estrogen at all around, then you take these phytoestrogens, you'll get a little proestrogen effect. But if there's too much estrogen around and you take them, you'll actually get an anti-estrogen effect. Are you confused yet? I know I am.
Okay.
So what are the plants that have the best track record for management of perimenopausal symptoms or menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and things like that.
Oh, wait. I don't have those kinds of symptoms.
I understand.
Yeah.
But what we're looking for is evidence that a certain dose is having a proestrogen effect.
Okay.
See, it's a direct indicator of menopause, right? So if someone takes an herb and their menopausal symptoms get better, we can say, okay, we're honing in on the dose of the herb that's having the estrogen-like effect. And we know from estrogen replacement studies with real estrogen that the dose that controls the hot flashes is usually about twice the dose that helps the bones. And so I think we can take that and extrapolate it to herbs and say that if you're at the dose that covers hot flashes, you're probably at the dose that covers bones. And we don't have studies looking at, say, use of soy estrogen or ginistin or some kind of soy protein derivative and bones over a long period of time looking for osteoporosis. But that's one of the estrogen benefits that you would presumably be after, right?
One of them.
Yeah. And then the cognitive benefits as well. So we only have like secondhand indirect evidence on the plants. And that's what I'm trying to say here. So what we have for bone protection are ginistin, black cohosh, red clover.
I'm sorry, what was the first one?
Ginistin, which is a soy isoflavone. So it's
ginistin,
in soy.
Mm-hmm.
G-E-N-I-S-T-E-N. And there are products out there that have various kinds of derivatives. There's black cohosh. There's other plants. There's lots of plants that have phytoestrogen activities.
Dongkwai
is one. Yep, that's a Chinese one. And they all do the same thing. They all are weak ligands for the estrogen receptor. And we like that because we think it gives protection for the bones. And we think that because it helps hot flashes. So in many women, that would logically go together. But the actual direct data is lacking, so you still should do the calcium, the weight-bearing exercise, the vitamin D level at above 35. Those are all things for bone health that you also want to do. And then the other benefits, the cognitive stuff, you should also be on a moderately high dose of fish oil. You want to keep those lipid membranes supple and unoxidized, and we know that fish oil works well for both of those. So we've covered cognitive and bone, and were there any other aging benefits that you were looking for from estrogen?
Yeah, I wanted to get more lubrication in my vagina.
Right, and that one is variable. I haven't seen a lot of success with reversing vaginal atrophy once it's there with herbs. I think that you may need to use short-term some actual estrogen, get those tissues back up to...
That's a cream?
Yeah, something
okay.
topical,
yeah.
Or one of the
one
of the inserts. Get the tissue back to normal, and then see if you can maintain it by a program of regular stimulation of the tissues, plus these vital hormones.
Okay.
Okay? But sometimes you have to actually use a drug to reverse the degeneration, let's call it.
Okay.
Okay, and genistein is spelled G-E-N-E-S-T-E-I-N. Okay, well, good luck to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Ember in Salinas. Hello, Ember. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. I tuned in, and I heard you, and I applaud you, and I want to just thank you for your honesty and your integrity, because
the one about the physicians having distributorships of medical devices.
I just have an intuitive feeling that medicine has just, being big pharma and big medicine has just gone too far.
You know, I don't think it has to be intuitive. I think that it's blazingly obvious to everybody.
Well, all right. call it what you will, but, and I applaud you and I thank you and I think for getting it out there and, helping people understand that they can be helping with their own healing.
Right.
You know, and helping people understand that there are legitimate and good things out there to help them, with their journey, you know, with their body.
Right.
But this big pharma is just a trouble for me. You know, every time I turn on the TV, you know, there's some big pharmaceutical, then they spend about 3 minutes telling you, look for this side effect, look for that side effect. Well, why are they putting it out there? If those side effects are, you know, wasn't there a time when they had to test things? for a while?
Well, that's how they know about all the side effects, is because, yes, we do have to test them. And there's a great deal of variability in people's biological systems. So when we talk about using a drug, you can pretty much count on somebody having trouble from the drug because of their unique system not being able to break it down, or because they're missing a protein that we don't even know exists, or there's so many possibilities. So given that, we're not lab rats, and there's a lot of differences between people.
Well,
it's going to happen.
The word is lab rats, and that troubles me because, of course, I'm an animal activist. I don't even know that we should even be testing things on animals.
Are you a vegetarian?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Well, I'm becoming more so. I'm more and more. It's hard for me to eat meat anymore.
Good. Because I think you have to be logically consistent.
No, I think our world, we're in a spiritual decline, all right?
Sure.
It troubles me that there's bullfighting, killing innocent animals, dogfighting. I mean, of course, they say the last days, but there's so many things that are wrong, and yet people are sitting there in a daze, not realizing that they're contributing to it. I mean, even when
Amber,
sports.
I think we're getting a little bit off topic.
All right, but I want to thank you. And
well, thank you for the call.
You make a lot of points, and thank you for having the courage to keep on.
All right, thank you very much. Interesting study that just came out from some Australian researchers. There is a holy grail looking for a weight loss drug, folks. I mean, there's so much money to be made if you find the weight loss drug. This was a very interesting use of a drug which already exists. And the drug in question is formoterol, which is F-O-R-M-O-T-E-R-O-L. This is a synthetic catecholamine, a synthetic form of epinephrine, if you will, that is an asthma drug. And it's used in inhalation. It's a long-acting bronchodilator, and it's beta-2 selective. Beta-2s are the epinephrine receptors in the lung. And beta-1 are the epinephrine receptors in the heart. And so one of the problems with asthma inhalers, many asthma drugs, is that they speed up the heartbeat and they make your heart pound and it's uncomfortable. And obviously if someone had a bad heart or poor blood flow, it could be dangerous. So for at least 2 decades, drug manufacturers have focused on trying to isolate the perfect beta-2 selective agonist, and formoterol is one of the latest, and it's a very good one. So these researchers decided, synthetic catecholamine, gee, that reminds me of a diet drug, like phentermine from Fen-Phen. How about if we turn this into a pill and try it as a diet drug? Well, they did. They increased the metabolism, the energy metabolism of their 8 subjects. It's only been tried in a few people. They got a 10% boost in metabolism, a 25% boost in fat burning, and their protein burning fell while they were on a weightless diet. So in other words, all good. They lost fat. They didn't lose muscle. They didn't get an increase in their heart rate, and they all lost weight. It's really, really intriguing, and I'm looking forward to hearing how that plays out in larger human studies. The DASH diet is in a test of rating of diets done by U.S. News and World Report. And this was pretty scientific. They had a panel of experts, and they rated diets across 7 categories, short-term weight loss, long-term weight loss, easiness to follow, nutritional completeness, ability to prevent or manage diabetes, and manage heart disease. So the best all-around diet was the DASH diet, which is the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. You can Google it. The Cliff's Note version of it is it's 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables and lots of dairy, and it works well. The Ornish diet captured the top spot for heart-healthy diets, with the Therapeutic Lifestyle Changes diet coming in second. The TLC diet is the one that I use clinically in my office because it is the easiest for people to follow and still eat out and have a life with their family. So, interesting news about weight loss. Let's go to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, Maria, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to answer your call about doctors, and I'm sorry, I have to laugh. It's hubris, I think, at this point. the arrogance of doctors who think that they can take a cut of the action, it's a payback, and then prescribe these devices to put into people's bodies. I'm stunned at the audacity of it. Okay, so that's that one. Regarding diet, it used to be just, you know, kind of a balanced diet, but, you know, diet and exercise. I don't see why people don't get the idea on that. Exercise is really good for burning the old fat off of the body. And a balanced diet is a good thing. A lot of fruit and vegetables and so on. I am surprised about the lots of dairy in that one diet you mentioned.
Yeah.
But there you go.
But that's the diet as it's been developed, and it was actually scientifically derived with the goal of reducing hypertension. So it wasn't derived with the goal of, you know, long-term cancer prevention, which is one of the places where the dairy might be problematic, you know. So you have to look at these things as, what's our goal? When you optimize any complex system, if you optimize for one thing, you're going to have to compromise elsewhere. You don't get to optimize for everything. So
Okay, so my question is, I have a friend who had an injury to her calcaneus, I guess it is, the heel bone, so-called.
Uh-huh. Yep.
A bit of it came off. She's very active and did a lot of jumping at one point last year and had this injury. And it's sore, it's, you know, uncomfortable, pretty uncomfortable for her, but she wants to continue to be active. One doctor has said, hey, a little surgery, I'll go in and pull that little thing out, and you'll be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And another, I think they just said, ibuprofen or whatever, pain maintenance. What are your thoughts on it?
I'm wondering where the little bit of bone is pulled off, because it actually is relevant to my answer. There are two
possible... It's on a plantar surface.
That's what I thought. So let me tell you, first of all, I'm predicating the answer on what I think your friend has. And so I'm going to answer as if that's what she actually has. And what I think she has is that over the years with repetitive trauma, the place where the tendons of the plantar fascia attach to the bone on the front bottom of the heel have calcified and developed calcium. And when you look at that on X-ray, it looks like the spur on a rooster. And so that's called a heel spur for that reason. And those are commonly seen on X-ray of people with foot pain, because guess what? We don't X-ray people who don't have foot pain. You know, we don't X-ray you because you're in the doctor's office and I need to pay for my machine. So as a result, there's an association of foot pain and heel spurs that is, I have to say this, probably spurious. And and the reason for that is it's death by association. So some of people have said that it's not really the spur itself that's causing the pain, that it's kind of in a way a third variable that's causing both the pain and the calcium deposit and therefore the spur. But in the traditional, direct, conventional medicine approach, it's like, you have pain, I take picture, I see heel spur, there's your pain right there. See, I can point to it. That must be your pain. And if I take it out, I take away your pain, because I have co-identified those two with direct causality. And the answer is maybe. So the first thing you do is take the conservative route, in my opinion, which is to assume that it's not the heel spur that's causing the pain, but that there's inflammation that's causing the pain, and address the inflammation. So the ibuprofen's not such a bad idea. The trouble is to take enough ibuprofen to really get at that inflammation. We're talking 600 to 800 three times a day. And that's really going to be hard on the intestinal walls, the boundaries, and you're going to get into secondary gut problems. I used to use ibuprofen with just impunity for these types of problems. And then I learned about how destructive it is to the gut environment and how it increases permeability. And I'm looking at all these people with food sensitivities, and I'm thinking, I really don't want to add to that whole distorted ecology. So I started using things like curcumin and turmeric and high-dose fish oil and hops extracts and other sorts of benign anti-inflammatories. Boswellia is a really good one. And lo and, yeah, and lo and behold, they...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't catch the name.
The last one's Boswellia. It's, it's, what was it, gold, frankincense, and myrrh?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so Boswellia is frankincense, I think. And yeah, it's either myrrh or frankincense. I don't remember. I always, the three kings and all of that in the Christmas story. But I make the association, but now I've forgotten which of the two it is. So now I'm, but it's interesting. That's a very good anti-inflammatory, which makes you wonder why it makes sense that the three wise men would have brought it. You know, because
yeah, they were tracking.
Yeah, they were tracking. Exactly. They need a good anti-inflammatory with them. So I've really gone in the direction of that because I haven't wanted to injure the bowel. Ice is good for inflammation in that area, and stretching, my goodness, stretching is key for plantar fasciitis. And with doing those things really consistently for several weeks, you start to see improvement in most people, in my experience, will improve with conservative measures, at which point you don't have to get surgery to remove the heel spur, which may or may not get rid of the problem.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
A lot of times I think the people who got cured by the surgery got cured by the cortisone shot that they left behind after the surgery directly into the plantar fascia, which is fine, but maybe there's a less radical way of achieving the same thing. Always try that first.
Yeah, well, I discouraged the surgeries. I said, you know, I mean, just because that's how I feel, and let's try a whole bunch of other things before the surgery and, you know, try something, see if it works.
Yes, well, try a lot of things at once. So the anti-inflammatory, the stretches, physical therapy, you want to do a comprehensive approach rather than a piecemeal approach. And that's
what I was surprised. I asked if they were giving her therapy and so on, and she said no. So that, whatever.
You know, usually what I do is give people a five-minute talk about how to do the exercise, and I figure, you know what, you're a grown-up. If you want this to be fixed, then you can, you know, do your own exercises. I really don't need to take an hour's worth of somebody's valuable professional time to babysit you to stretch your heel cord. You know, come on.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay. And so when you say the stretches, you're talking about dorsiflexion, right?
Right. Dorsiflexion with a rubber band or a rope, and also on stairs. Dorsiflexion on stairs on stairs is really good.
With a good warm-up before.
You got it. Hey, you must be a regular listener. You know a lot of medicine.
Well, no, I actually have a certificate as a fitness instructor.
So very good.
A little bit.
Okay, very
thank
good.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye. Oh, and by the way, Charlie checked, and frankincense is Boswellia, or frankincense is an extract of Boswellia, depending on how you want to think about it. Recent research, this is very cool, validating the idea that you can maybe detect ovarian cancer early with PET scans. This is PET-CT imaging, so I'm not sure exactly how much radiation it involves. And they do use a radioactive glucose tracer. That's yet not usually very radioactive, so that's probably not dangerous. But the idea that we might be able to find ovarian cancers early, or maybe what we do is a two-step thing where we monitor the blood for a serum marker, and then when we see the serum marker, we do a CT PET scan before operating on people, that could be a really good 1-2 approach for ovarian cancer. So stay tuned on that one. But PET scans shown to detect early ovarian cancer, so not just for tumor staging anymore. Another interesting research story involves cancer. This is coming out of the LA Times by Thomas Mao, and it's a story of two drug companies collaborating, putting two drugs together to try and treat tumors. This is about melanoma treatment, and there are two drugs that have been used separately. They're just new things. They're all monoclonal antibodies attacking different receptors or acting as ligands to trigger and turn on receptors. So one of them is a Bristol drug called, and they always end in AB, so this one is ipilimumab. They've chosen a rather odd trade name, Yervoy, which really isn't as catchy as the usual drug name. Anyway, Yervoy and an experimental drug by Roche, which is vimirafenib, I love these names, is going to be used together. The idea is that if we can combine these drugs, maybe we can get better effects on melanoma and prevent its metastasis, which is just an absolute huge, huge issue. A new research technique that was used in this study caught my eye. This was a study published in Cell Metabolism June 7th. The researchers were looking at a compound in apple peels. The compound is ursolic acid, and they found that it turned on genes in muscles that promoted the response to fasting that would be healthy. In other words, they gave mice these compounds and they looked for gene markers. In other words, they looked at what genes got turned on and started producing proteins. This is a proteomic study. And they found that there were changes in gene expression that would basically, in the case of a fasting mouse, the changes in gene expression would cause muscle wasting. In other words, the mouse would turn on the factory to break down muscle protein to create glucose to keep from starving. And they had a signature. You know, it takes these 29 genes get upregulated and we start to see these proteins in the cytosol and then we see muscle wasting. So then they said, well, what could we use bioactively that might inhibit that? And they just have these big trays now that read the proteins that are produced by these cells, and they'll just throw a chemical on and see what happens and run the tray again and throw another chemical on and see what happens. So they had 1,300 bioactive small molecules that had maybe some possibility that they might prevent the muscle atrophy, and they just screened them all, and the winner is ursolic acid. So expect to see this coming to a pharmacy near you as an extract. But in the short run, the old apple a day keeps the doctor away. It comes through again. And every time there's a story about apples, one is tempted to run it just because of that old adage. And let's go to Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, usually I haven't had any trouble swallowing pills. And lately, they seem to get stuck somewhere in my throat. And I'm feeling sort of a bit of a lump in my throat. And that's one of the questions. So I'm wondering about thyroid. Mm-hmm. And the other is, I know I've been diagnosed as having a bit of a hiatal hernia. And I don't know whether it's getting stuck in there or... Anyway, I...
Well, let me just ask you, do you notice a difference when you swallow liquids versus solids? Like food, you know, versus juice or something.
Well,
like
one of the things that I do sometimes, if I swallow solids, they seem to go down better.
Okay.
A bit. I mean, well, liquids. I seem to be able to swallow liquids okay, but in terms of like the pills, if I have mm-hmm. something solid, that makes it go down better.
Right. So the reason I'm asking this is because people who have a fixed physical blockage near their esophagus and their larynx, let's say their thyroid's enlarged, let's say that they have a lymph node, you know, a lymphoma or something, or that's grown inside and is pushing on the esophagus, they will generally notice that swallowing solid food is harder than liquid food.
Uh-huh.
And so they'll be picking it up when they're like eating steak or having something like a rice cracker, and they'll notice trouble with dry foods in particular, but solid foods. A person who has a reflux, let's say a heartburn or acid coming up, sometimes that acid will cause irritation of the mucosal layer and it makes the mucosal layer sticky. So I'm wondering if your hiatal hernia might be causing a little bit of an acid burn up there in the back of your pharynx, you know, near where your actual swallowing mechanism is, and that your pills are getting stuck back there because the mucosa is a little sticky
uh-huh.
from being inflamed. And so when you have the pills stuck, pills get stuck easily. I mean, if you get a pill wet and, you know, it'll stick to your finger, the gelatin mm-hmm. kind of gets gluey very rapidly. So it could be just that kind of a phenomenon rather than a physical blockage.
Uh-huh.
And so asking about solid versus liquids is one of my differentiators for that. That being said, it could be an enlarged thyroid. Do you feel any lumps in your neck when you feel around? Any asymmetry when you look in the mirror?
I don't notice anything obvious. Okay. I mean, I feel sort of a lump in my throat, not from outside, but from inside.
Right, right. And that is a fairly straightforward evaluation. So one does some sort of barium study. Usually you swallow the liquid and we look to see that the esophagus looks normal on the inside, kind of gives us a cast of the esophagus, if you will, on x-ray, and it's ultrasound of the neck to look for lymph nodes, masses, enlarged thyroid, or, you know, really rare stuff like zinc or diverticulum, which is a outpouching of tissue in the esophagus. It's quite rare. You know, you sort of look for those things, and if you don't find them, then the sensation you feel in your throat could be what's called globus, G-L-O-B-U-S. It's probably the most common cause of a quote-unquote lump in the throat. You can look that up in a medical dictionary or just put it into your browser and you'll get a good definition of it. You can see if that matches with what you're experiencing.
So I have a follow-up question. You were saying that it might be from reflux of somewhat of stickiness.
Yes.
And it's like, even if I guess I have heard that you can have reflux without having any pain.
Yes, you can, especially if you sleep through it.
Uh-huh.
When you're lying down, that's the time that the acid is most likely to get all the way up into your throat and be bothersome without your being aware of it.
Okay. So I guess you have all the stuff about what to do about that, because I don't have any.
Yes. If you go on the website to askdrdon.com and hit resources, there is a good little page of hints for preventing reflux, and most of those things will obviously help with that problem at night.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Okay.
Good
luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go to Artemis. We've had such interesting names. We had Demeter and we've had Artemis. We're having a very Greek morning. Was she Greek or Roman?
Greek.
Okay, good. So how can I help you today?
Hi, I just want to address the practice that is so widespread that people aren't really thinking about, I don't think.
Go ahead.
Coffee. People drink coffee all the time.
Yes.
And to me, I've been off coffee for a while, and every time I take it, I have several symptoms that are very negative. One of them is inflammation, and the other one is nervousness, and the other, I mean, there are several. So I wonder if you can address how coffee really is destructive, not helpful, in people's diets.
Okay.
Can you do that?
Sure. I absolutely can.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay. So, first of all, it's a mixed bag, as it is with anything. Coffee does contain a lot of good antioxidant compounds, and those have been shown to be beneficial. There are plenty of studies that have documented the benefits of coffee as far as cognition and the ability for people to pass tests and remember things. So it's a performance-enhancing drug in that respect. There are plenty of studies looking at the effect of coffee as a stimulant of the intestine, which can be good or bad depending on the problem. It's also a cardiac stimulant, which is generally bad under most circumstances. And I think the most toxic effect of coffee is actually a side effect of our very high-pressured society. And it's kind of an amplification in people's general edginess and irritability. And I certainly notice that irritability is a contagious disease, and it's one that's epidemic in our culture. So maybe the increase in irritability to a certain extent has tracked with the increase in coffee consumption, which has gone up in terms, not a volume, but in terms of milligrams of caffeine and strength of the coffee quite a bit with the advent of different brewing technologies over the years. So in the long run, I think that coffee makes you edgy, and while it does contain helpful antioxidants, you can get it other ways. And that edginess creates a general cultural environment that is toxic and destructive to our peace of mind. So maybe we do need to get a little bit more moderate and rethink our coffee consumption. Let's go now to Judy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Judy. We have just a couple of minutes, but I wanted to give you a chance.
Thank you. I was wondering about, you, mentioned gut permeability and ibuprofen affecting that. And I was wondering if there were other over-the-counter NSAIDs or other medications.
Yes, thank you for asking that because I wasn't clear. I was speaking of Motrin, but I should have been talking about the class effect. It is a class effect for all of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And you can't get around it because the action of the drug is to block the formation of the prostaglandin E2. And E2 is protective mucus. It stimulates the production of protective mucus in the intestines and the stomach. So you block that with the NSAIDs, whether you give them by injection or you give them orally. So there's a direct toxicity just from the pill being an irritant, but then there's this much more pernicious toxicity, which is that if you degrade the mucus, then you do definitely increase the problems with permeability because that mucus is protective mucus.
And then also about antihistamines, would those have any effect on the gut permeability?
I am not aware of that being a problem as long as there's no non-steroidal anti-inflammatory along for the ride. A lot of products are combo products.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We've come to the end of another hour. And I want to thank you for listening. Thank those who called in for calling and invite you to go online to AskDrDawn.com. Explore the website, check out some links, maybe give me some feedback or ask your questions on the contact us box that you'll find right there. Thanks to Charlie Mansky, my producer, phone answerer, and the webmaster and editor of this program. This is Ask Dr. Dawn. So long and stay healthy.